Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Well, today, I'm more excited than I've been in a long time. And let me tell you why. Firstly, joined by Tyler Combwood, who has co-hosted this super, super episode that we've just created. She is a former Defense Intelligence Agency cybersecurity deputy chief and senior intelligence officer, amongst other things. And it's a pleasure, Tyler, to have you host this show.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. So thank you.
Absolutely lovely. And I am Nathaniel Schooler. I'm a tech industry analyst and advocate, and I am the principal consultant at The Influencer Marketing Company. And today we talked with some very senior people in the UK police force about the UK's collaborative cybersecurity policing model 2020 and beyond. And we interviewed some amazing people, including Mandy Hayburn Little. And I've got your name right today, which is fantastic. And you are the chief executive of the Business Resilience International Management. We've also got Peter Goodman, who is the National Police Lead for Serious and Organized Crime at the National Police Chiefs Council. We've got Andy Gould, who is Detective Superintendent of the National Cybercrime Program and National Police Chiefs Council. And also Philip Donnelly, who is managing the technology over there he's with the NPCC Cybercrime Program. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really nice that you took the time to join us. I'm quite excited, actually, to learn more about all of this. And I've got one question that I'm going to ask at the beginning. And Peter, you've been responsible for the introduction of the National Cyber Program within policing. What do you see is being the main benefit to come from that?
Oh gosh, that's a big question because there are so many different benefits. I mean, I think all of this is about making the community in the UK safer from cybercrime. And when I say the community, I mean big business, I mean small and medium-sized business, and I mean the individual. And one of the watchwords that I've had right from the start and shared with Andy is, if we forget about Mrs. Miggins at 1 Acacia Avenue, then we've failed in our task for protecting the public. Because a lot of the attention gets focused on attacks on businesses and enterprise, but actually it's Mrs. Miggins losing her 32,000 life savings through a cyber attack who's actually really at the sharp end of all of this. So it's been my pleasure and privilege to lead this team during the course of the last 8 years. And, you know, we've moved from a situation where there are only about 130 people working in cybercrime, and all of them in London, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. And that had been a very recent development led by my predecessor, Janet Williams, fantastic woman. But here we are now eight years later, and there's over 1,000 people, you know, who are investigators, who are intelligence officers, who are, you know, protecting, working to protect businesses and individuals from harm, stopping people going into cybercrime. You know, we've got capability in the dark web. We've got capability around cryptocurrency. We've changed the whole of the policing approach to this. And hopefully all that change has meant that Mrs. Miggins of 1 Acacia Avenue is much safer than she was 8 years ago.
Super.
That is such a great answer. Peter, I'm going to ask you this again. So you were the chief constable responsible for the introduction of cyber performance indicators within policing. So why was that an important step for the UK?
It was an important step because it meant that we could quantify what we were doing, and it meant that we could assess the risk as well. And let me give you a really good example of why it was necessary. If we slip over into the world of counterterrorism, mm-hmm. counterterrorism in the UK has had a lot of investment during the course of the last 20 years, obviously because of the international situation. But a big part of that was the ability of the intelligence agencies to say, you know what, government, there are at least 2,000 people out there who are actively plotting to commit a terrorist act here or abroad. And there's about 10,000 who we also think are interested in becoming involved in that. And this is the capacity we've got. So they were able to demonstrate very clearly the, you know, the very real threat to the UK and the ability of policing and the broader security services to respond to it. And that led government into an inevitable position where they had to invest, not just because of the atrocities, but because of the very clear intelligence picture and performance picture that they were producing. So we've tried very much to copy that in cyber, because nobody anywhere quite knows the full extent of cyber. I think we all know, we know the vectors of attack, we know it's big, we know it's cost billions, but we don't actually know completely what it is. But we are able to demonstrate through the performance regime that it really is that big. And look at what these our people are doing. Look at what we've delivered to make the UK safer. Mm-hmm. But actually, there needs to be continued investment, because without that, we aren't protecting our communities in the way that we should. So it was about us understanding what we're doing, but also being able to have a proper intelligent dialogue with government about investment.
Oh, thank you. That is such a great answer. I'm going to go to Andy next. Andy, how has COVID affected the UK cybersecurity? And do you think businesses need to take extra measures while many people are working remotely? And sorry, this is a three-part question. And what lessons have we learned thus far in terms of online security due to COVID?
That's a really good question. I think what we've seen is kind of, COVID was unexpected, but if we'd actually considered the impact of a pandemic and how we might respond to it in the cyber world, it would probably have played out largely how we predicted. So there's a sudden rush from an organizational point of view. Suddenly, almost overnight, everybody had to work from home. So there was a mad rush to get the hardware, the infrastructure, and everybody up and running to maintain business as usual. And I think it would probably be fair to say that maybe, you know, everyone knew that security would be important, but businesses weren't going to stop doing business while they sorted the security out. So you suddenly got a position where, you know, everyone's on their home router, with all the vulnerabilities that we know come from that. Basically, all the endpoints are no longer owned by the organizations themselves. So they've kind of delegated responsibility for securing the most important assets within the business to a bunch of often junior staff at home who have no understanding of maybe some of the responsibilities that come from that, and certainly haven't been supplied with the kit and the capability to manage it. So I think what we've seen is businesses, to their credit, have done a brilliant job in managing that kind of that crisis and getting through the storm. And some have managed really quite incredibly. But I think there's been a big rush to catch up. Now they've kind of jerry-built all these networks and this infrastructure. Now they need to work backwards and protect it. We've heard a number of people kind of describe it as going from having a handful of offices to 10,000 offices. And it being that kind of that home vulnerabilities being really significant. And the vulnerabilities that come from that are often quite obvious. So you've got the kind of accessing into networks, the access controls, the infrastructure itself, all the things that you would expect to come from that are there, but people are having to kind of rush at scale to plug those gaps. And of course, that's complicated by the fact that the teams that would normally be in the office to protect the corporate are now also at home, or maybe they've been furloughed, or maybe they're sick. So suddenly the ability to deal with that crisis, there's less resilience to do that because of the position that everyone's found themselves in. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's all rushing out to try and reconfigure or buy hardware at no notice, upgrade. Some businesses have really succeeded in that and some haven't. And I think the effects of that will take months or maybe even years to play out. So from a policing point of view, what's been quite interesting is we saw a significant spike in reporting of cybercrime in those initial few weeks. But the increase in reporting was domestic reporting. It was members of the public identifying they had a problem and reporting that crime. Maybe that was because there was a spike I suspect there may well have been, and a lot of that was using COVID as a lure. But actually, that might be also because they had more time on their hands; they were more willing to report, whereas maybe they would have never got around to it in the first place. So it's difficult to say if one's caused the other or one is the kind of the product of the other. But what we didn't see an increase in was business reporting. So the big worry, I think, for us is, as businesses more and more come back to work, staff get back into office, they start to drill into the systems in a way that they haven't been able to do at home, are we going to find a whole load of unidentified nastiness? And you would kind of expect that to be the case with the increased vulnerability that has been created and the reduced level of protection. You would expect there to be a real spike in damage, but that hasn't come through in terms of reporting yet. So are we sat on this kind of ticking malware time bomb? Right. We just don't know, but we suspect we may be.
That what a great answer. Philip, do you have anything to add to that, like in terms of lessons that we've learned from COVID? Have we seen different types of attacks?
No, I mean, the criminals are always changing the way that they do the attacks. And you know, that they're very quick to respond to the COVID crisis. So, you know, the types of phishing campaigns that were coming out changed to match into what was going on. But we see that all the time. You know, something happens and then they're very quick to jump on the bandwagon and to say, well, this has happened. Well, suddenly people are getting emails that are focused on that. So the types of attacks, the phishing campaigns, the ransomware, the underlying technology is the same that they're using. They're just matching it to the current crisis and what's going on. So suddenly all the holiday's been cancelled. So suddenly lots of people getting emails that are purportedly from the holiday company to say, click on here and you can have this happen. And people want, you know, the general public, you know, want to get their money back. They want to be able to do that. So people are clicking on the links because they're in a rush to get things happen. And that's what people are playing on. They're playing on that human element to try and through clicking on the button to get something to happen. Like sending, you know, your campaign out on a Friday afternoon when people are ready to go home. And that type of stuff. They're playing on that, well, I'll just get it done, rather than on a, you know, Monday morning. People are more likely to pay attention to what's in front of them.
But amid all the kind of the chaos and the disaster and the tragedy, there have been some real positives as well. So talking purely from a policing perspective and maybe a little bit more broadly than just cyber, actually, when there was that kind of, initially when everyone went into lockdown, calls and demands on policing massively dropped. But that was actually a brilliant, unexpected opportunity for policing. Our sickness rates didn't go up, our staff still came to work, but suddenly they were free from the day-to-day, often non-policing demand, less serious demand, to really focus on the priorities. So you had some like really, really big forces, or a lot of forces across the UK deciding, right, all the people that are out there that are wanted, that have gone missing, that we don't have the time day-to-day to really go after, suddenly there's time to go and do that. You look at the work that's happening around EncroChat. That didn't slow down during COVID. That accelerated. That's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to clear the decks of really top-end organised criminality. And that went ahead utilising teams from across the UK, across all parts of organised crime. And we'll be working off the back of that for months and years to come, which is just amazing. So people have had the opportunity to really focus on their priorities. And you talked to a lot of the operational staff in the cybercrime units that went home overnight. The productivity went up. There are teams that have increased productivity by 10, 20%. And maybe we waste an awful lot of our time in unproductive management meetings. Who knows? people have just gone out and cracked on and done some amazing work. And that's true in the private sector as it is in law enforcement. I think that people will look back and, you know, there aren't many positives that come out of this, but actually there'll be whole new ways of working, whole new people are wanting to create, innovate in the public sector and the private sector. We'll be doing things in ways we would never have imagined a year ago. So it's accelerated some real positives and reminded people that haven't got into that kind of digital or technology enabled areas of business, whether it's law enforcement or others, you need to do that or you will become irrelevant. Or in fact, you're already irrelevant. You just didn't realize it yet. And I think COVID has brought that home to a lot of people.
That is such a great point. I mean, a lot of people focus on how, you know, all the bad parts of the pandemic, but what you just said is true. You know, it's also, you know, we're seeing all kinds of entrepreneurship and all kinds of other good working types of environments that are coming from this too. So it is a time that we can really come up with new techniques and methodologies. I think that was such a great answer.
Yeah.
Tyler, on the back of that, I would just, and this is me just being a bit non, this is the other side of the coin. It's also, I mean, we've known for a long while that serious organized criminals are becoming increasingly digital in the ways that they work. And we've seen, particularly through some of the intelligence we've seen through the EncroChat stuff, we've seen that because normal criminal working practices, because it's a business model, isn't it? The normal business model wasn't available to many of our organized criminals, so they went online, you know, and some of them went online and started committing cyber offenses, but some went online and made digital, you know, communication a much bigger part of their business. So the kind of downside of that entrepreneurship, the downside of that is that we've seen that also in the organized crime community as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess everyone has we went from maybe being, I don't know, 90% reliant on digital devices and the internet to really much higher, like 99% when everyone started working from home.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate though that, you know, so many vulnerable people get hit by these scammers, and that really makes me quite sad when I hear of old age pensioners and, you know, people even getting these automated phone calls. I mean, these things are just absolutely dreadful, really. But I mean, we're more here to talk about business, aren't we? And I wanted to ask Mandy just a brief question, because the cyber resilience centers are growing quite quickly, and you know, we're really excited about how they're going to help small and medium-sized businesses and obviously large businesses throughout the supply chain as well. So I wondered sort of what agencies are involved and what makes them unique, and how are they the best way to protect the UK's cyber critical infrastructure and business?
Okay, so in terms of those who are supporting this, and it's a really core support, the Home Office like this model very much, and they've been involved from the outset in really understanding and interrogating where it can assist. And as you say, we want this to be accessible to every size of business. So for some of the larger companies who already have very sophisticated internal models, this is all about innovation. This is all about new blood, new thinking, brand new student skills coming in and being available to you. And of course, for the medium size, there's a whole set of membership opportunities. There's that real comfort in being part of a trust community. So everything is verifiable. You'll know you're absolutely getting the best state-of-the-art advice. And then the smaller side, I'll come on to in just a moment. But from that, I mean, I do talk about this as being a mark of real courage for UK as a whole, because I think for policing and particularly the chief constables nationally to agree that this is one model, and we're going to follow the advice of Pete Goodman, who's been invaluable in terms of saying, we've seen this work elsewhere, I think we should do this. But actually to bring in and to nurture that relationship with private sector and with academia is such a win-win. So we're starting to look at the future skills pipeline. We're paying the best students, excuse me, we're looking at inclusion, and we're actually trying to forge those links right across the business community. But I think for me, there is something about an absolute clarity of tone and message. So if we can create out of this massive confusion, everybody claiming to be the best cyber advice, the most knowledgeable expert, if we can create that one place that even 80% of the business community go to, then it will grow incrementally. And that value that it will bring, I think, to the UK is substantial. And that's why I think the vision that the UK have had in doing this has been really powerful, and very quickly it's attracted very high levels of interest internationally. Our focus for now is absolutely in getting these 9 centres right across England and Wales in super smart time. So, I mean, it is quite an ask, but everybody is so willing to do this. So I think the more that we can engage, I mentioned the Home Office, the Police Chiefs Council, and we work really closely with the National Cybersecurity Centre. So another absolutely trusted point of discussion and interest and communications for business. And we have to, I see these as being evolutionary. So nothing ever stops still in business, and actually they should change over a period of time. But already Andy Gold and Phil Donnelly have been working on a new model that they can also bring into the cyber centres. And I say that because they shouldn't stand still. You should come back in 2 years and say, oh, you're doing that now. You know, that's how it should be.
Super. Well, thank you. That's much appreciated. I think you're doing some great work, all of you in this area, you know. So, Tyler, what's your next question?
Well, I'll ask this to really everybody. I'll start with Mandy. How can the private sector get involved in this network?
So one of the core points of ethos for the centres is that they're not for profit and they preserve public good. And I say that because it means that whatever income is generated goes back into making them self-sustaining. So if you are a large or a medium-sized company who would like to work directly on that alignment to policing cyber strategy, to future focus, we would very much welcome your involvement. And we've been talking to national companies. So you can provide a modest amount towards the setting up of the regional boards, to ensuring that there is excellent governance in all of the cyber centres. But shortly, we will be announcing some more opportunities for business to come in and to be aligned to that UK-wide growth as well. And then the smaller ones, of course, can be members, and we hope that everybody will use the quite unique student services as well.
It's really very, very exciting.
Tyler, can I come in? Can I come in next on that,
yes,
Tyler?
Please.
It's really interesting because we've had a couple of days now that Mandy's pulled together where we've had the opportunity to spend 2 hours or so with representatives from some of the biggest businesses in the UK, well, international businesses, which have a big footprint in the UK. And just even without any of them committing to any future help or finance, or just opening up what we're doing to them, has brought about some brilliant new ideas from them, which will add value. And as Mandy says, you know, this is a model which is meant to develop. You know, we're building a foundation here, aren't we, Mandy? And on top of the foundation, we'll build the first floor, which is the basic services of the centre. But every year, we want to build another floor. So there are more and more services, more and more capacity and capability to protect the UK. And we've received some really, really fantastic ideas today. Just one from, you know, from a company, an American company actually, that works in the UK as well. I thought, you know what, we could, you know, if we work with you, and if every time we take on new business clients, we talk to them about their cybersecurity and we ask them to become part of the regional cyber resilience centres, imagine what kind of reach we would have if all of their supply chain became part of the centres. Then suddenly our reach tenfolds, hundredfolds, a thousandfolds really quickly. So even just the value of talking, it helps us to develop the model better.
I mean, it's so brilliant. It's such a brilliant, scalable living model, and you know, I hope that that other countries can really adopt this model too.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot of potential.
The thing that's interesting for us, I think we've probably not realised the value of maybe what we've built. I think we're always looking and thinking, well, this could be better, this should be better. where do we go in the future? But actually, when you sit back and reflect where we've come as a country over the last few years, a handful of years ago, like Pete said, we had virtually nothing. Now we've got regional cybercrime units working across investigations into organised crime, providing for really high quality protection advice for business, diverting young people from cybercrime. And now we've at the local level, we've got force units finally picking up the slack for the volume crime. So you're a small or medium-sized enterprise or a member of the public, you'll probably get an investigation. If there are viable lines of inquiry, you will get an investigation. Where there aren't any viable lines, you will get prevention advice. You will get contact. So suddenly you're getting as good a level of service, if not better, than in the same way as any other area of policing. That's a huge step forward. But actually, that kind of for us feels like, okay, that's the minimum level. That is a largely reactive service, apart from some of the interesting proactive work we're doing against some of the organised crime groups. But how do we start to really industrialise this and scale this and have an impact? But first, I think there's a blueprint that could go internationally. But the centres are a brilliant opportunity to really kind of industrialise that messaging, have that impact, bring the students in as a skills pipeline for us in the private sector. But also something that we've just started building that we're just launching today as a bit of a pilot. What we're calling police cyber alarm is basically this idea where in the UK there is no clear picture of the current threat. So GCHQ and NCSE have got brilliant insight to what's coming into the UK infrastructure, but by law they can't monitor domestically. You've got businesses, particularly really big businesses, have got great insight of what's hitting them, but they don't really know what's hitting their competitors across the sector or broader economy. And then you've got us in policing that have got a really good understanding of what's hitting victims that then come and report to us. But that's a tiny percentage of the overall impact. And because that relies on them, A, identifying they've been hit, and B, having the confidence and time to come and report it to us, which can all be a little bit manual and delayed. So everyone's got a piece of the puzzle. There's no way of bringing all that together. So the idea behind police cyber alarm is we want, particularly SMEs, but anyone else that wants to play, quite frankly, we want to get these companies to volunteer to put a police cyber alarm on their networks, bit of software, and then we will get the firewall, the denied firewall traffic, suspicious activity data coming into us. Obviously, the more businesses sign up, the better picture we get. But then that will start in time to drive all our policing activity. So we'll start to develop to identify the UK-based criminality, and then we can still work internationally. But that will really drive what we call our protect messaging, the cyber prevention advice. Then we've got something really powerful to actually offer business, because we've got that day-to-day insight in a way that nobody else will have if we can scale it. Then the benefit for those businesses are, you know, they'll get a monthly vulnerability scan that will help them understand their vulnerabilities better. But they'll also get lifetime automated alerts where we identify where they've potentially been breached or got a problem they need to go and look at. So they'll get some kind of real-time value, almost like a mini SOC, although I'm loath to describe it that way because we're not going to be building a big UK SOC for this. But the benefits from business then hopefully are obvious. They get an idea of what's hitting them that maybe they're not recognising. The benefits for us are we can share that more broadly and see that threat picture day to day. I don't think anybody's trying that anywhere in the world in that way. But if we can find a way to scale through the centres and with other private sector partners, suddenly we can hit a lot of the economy in a way that we just couldn't as police, and a slightly more physical, manual, go out, knock on doors, sign up people. If we can scale with partners who do this day to day, then we can all benefit from that data, from that insight, and then use that to drive all our collective activity. I mean, imagine if you're in Durham or York or Birmingham and you can get from your local police a lifetime picture of what's hitting companies within Durham or Birmingham or York. That's really powerful. And I think that's much more powerful than having a London-centric national picture. It makes it a lot more real. And if those individual organisations are being told, this is what's specifically hitting you, suddenly becomes a more real conversation for the board. These are your specific vulnerabilities. This is what has potentially successfully hit you in the last week or so. And then that starts to drive those more positive security behaviours. So we're hoping if it scales, if people are willing to share that data at scale with policing, this could be a really, really powerful tool to complement the centres, promote it through the centres. And the UK model is then something I think really powerful to try and promote around the world.
I think it's wonderful. I mean, I think the benefit, there are so many benefits for businesses to join in, because it's kind of added cybersecurity. They have all of their cybersecurity, but you're also doing a lot of work for them to alert them if there's been some kind of problem. I think it's great. You also, if you see suspicious traffic, or you see IP addresses or different types of malware, you have that, and you can then put a signature to it and look for it if you see it in any other business being attacked by the same threat actors.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
Exactly.
And Tyler, on top of that, just another benefit which comes out of it. One of the battles we've had over a long period of time is, you know, chief constables in this country have geographic responsibility for a certain patch in the UK. Loads of different responsibilities. And some of my chief constable colleagues have taken a lot of persuading to invest in cyber capabilities. Because you know what? It's not been reported like burglary is, or vehicle crime is, or violent crime is. And they want to concentrate on those. And it's been quite difficult for me to turn around to them and say, you know what, this is what cybercrime looks like in your force area. This is what victimology looks like in your force area. Because we didn't have the data. You know, we had a small amount of reporting, but that no way reflects the reality of people's experience. If we can get to a situation where we could say every month to every chief constable in the country, this is what your force profile looks like. This is what, these are the vectors of attack. These are the volumes. These are the number of victims who have been victims of a successful attack. Suddenly, they've got no excuse for doing nothing, or no excuse for doing as little as possible.
Yeah, very much so. And then they can lead communications campaigns locally targeted to individuals and businesses. It's a no-brainer, really. But I think getting scale, because people are just paranoid about their data, aren't they? Like, giving away data is like, it's like everyone becomes a conspiracy theorist around what people are going to do with it, when actually the intent behind it is solid. You know, it's a tough one, really.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to stress the data we're collecting is the metadata from firewalls. So it's the firewall logs. We're not capturing traffic. So we're only interested in the metadata. That's what we're able to utilize to build up the threat intelligence picture.
Gotcha.
So everything we're doing is transparent. You know, it's ethical. We're not capturing the data. You know, if people want more information, we have a website, cyberalarm.police.uk, where there's lots more information around the program and the projects, and organizations can, if they want to sign up. We're only in a number of regions at this moment in time, but, you know, if the pilot is successful, the idea is to roll it out nationally. And then, you know, the more organizations we have on the platform, the bigger threat intelligence picture we have an understanding of, so we can then go sector specific. So we can look at, well, what's impacting on, you know, it could be florists, it could be any sector, it doesn't matter what the sector is. We can narrow down to that, but we can also look regionally. So it gives us a full understanding of exactly what's going on, who's attacking UK-based organisations.
And those data, the privacy concerns are really, really important. So it's why we've kind of gone public almost before we started, because what we don't want is people who don't understand it, or maybe just might understand it, but got their own reasons for attacking it and almost killing it before it started, thinking it's some, you know, there's some secret police program to gather data. It's not secret. Each company signs up voluntarily to do it. We've got a public website that says exactly what we're doing. You know, we've got all the data processing impact assessments and contracts and terms and conditions coming out of our ears. It's really important that people can see it and understand it to reassure them. I mean, there'll be those that will always be anti. There are those there are people that aren't happy that we can use fingerprints and DNA, and the value of that has been the same for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So, but it's important that where people do have legitimate and reasonable concerns, we can try and allay those fears by being really open and transparent, and people can see what we're doing because we've gone public. You can see it. People can sign up to it. We're encouraging those companies to amend the privacy policies on the website so people can see, and hopefully people will consent and it will grow. But we'll have to see what happens. I'm sure we'll have some privacy challenges along the way.
Possibly, but I think being upfront about what you're doing is going to help that. And you know, it's interesting because oftentimes people have no problem giving up all kinds of very, very personal information to social media sites. And But then there's a concern when you're trying to help with something like this. You know, how do you kind of, is there a way in the middle that you can make people kind of comfortable or use that as kind of some way of saying, well, yes, we understand your privacy. We're very concerned about it, and somehow compare it kind of to the what is being given up on social media sites.
It's a very good idea, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think that will be part of the messaging. And actually, probably the analogies we use are in terms of using CCTV, which is very prevalent in the UK. There's no real controversy around it. It's been around for so long. But the kind of suspicious activity data that we're collecting is kind of equivalent to CCTV picking up someone trying to break into your home or your business. We're only capturing the images of people trying to break in. We're not capturing the images of people coming into your house or your business day to day, permanently, legitimately. So it's not like we're taking it, retaining it, not looking at it. We're just not taking it in the first place. It's only the stuff that you've identified as an organization that you find suspicious, because that's the way you've kind of configured your firewall. That's the only stuff that's being shared with us.
But again, how we approach it is really important, because the future, I think we all know the future is data, don't we? That it'll sit at the center of everything, and big data will sit at the center of everything. And law enforcement and government are going to have to use big data if they're going to be relevant at all. And that involves lots and lots of people's data, some of which is personal as well. But actually getting people warmed up to that idea is really, it takes a long time. There's always a lag. You know, when there was a lag with CCTV in the UK where lots of people are against it, it's now part and parcel of our daily lives. There was a lag with comms data where people didn't like it. It's now part and parcel of people's lives. And there will be a lag with this. And how you manage that lag is really important. And it's all about transparency, honesty, and not having any instance where it gets lost or misused.
Yeah.
Again, even with this though, you know, we aren't taking any personal data at all. We're just, you know, it's the metadata we're interested in. But people, and so telling that upfront is really important, and demonstrating that's what we're doing.
Exactly, because that just will make people feel more comfortable and they'll want to be included, because they gain so much from joining into this network.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Sorry.
It's very exciting. I'm really excited about it.
Oh, wait, fingers crossed it works.
it will.
Yeah.
So here's a good question. I'll just kind of throw this one out there. So all of you have a great deal of experience in law enforcement and crime prevention. What are three things that businesses and individuals can do right now to protect themselves and their assets from cyber threats?
Who wants to go first? Shall I go first?
Can do, boss.
I'll do the individual first, because as I said, Mrs. Miggins, 1 Acacia Avenue. That's where we have to start. And it's just basic hygiene, isn't it? Basic hygiene. You know, if something looks like it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. So don't click on it. You know, don't click on links to sites you don't know and you're not aware of. You know, don't fall for the HMRC scan. Make sure you have passwords that are made up in the way that NCSC say they should be made up. Three random words. And if you find it difficult to remember your passwords, then use a password locker and keep them in there. Make sure that you just operate really good cyber hygiene in everything that you do, and make sure you keep your patching up to date, and make sure you have an antivirus software on. You know, all the basic things will protect the members of the public, individual members of the public, from 80% of cyber attacks.
Wow. Just by doing that's incredible.
Super.
I suppose the other big one, I think Peter's nicked the best three. But if you think that ransomware is the biggest threat to business, which it is, certainly in the UK, well, it almost doesn't matter. You can have every area of your security fail and you can probably recover. The one area where you can't recover is if you haven't got effective backups. And those companies that haven't backed up effectively, there's a good chance they won't come back from ransomware. That will be the end of them. So if you're an organization, if there was one thing you were really going to focus on, over and above the things that Peter's already said, it's effective backups that have been tested and you've exercised and you've tried to come back. They're not all on the same network, all the obvious things that, you know, people fall foul of even when they got backups. As an organization, you can't come back from having no effective backups from ransomware. So that has to be an organization's priority.
That's great.
Yeah. I suppose for myself, I would say understand your network as a business, understand your vulnerabilities, understand what ports you've got open. You would understand your physical world. If you've got an office block in a building, you'd understand what that's our front door in. We're not going to leave the fire doors open. People would understand that in the real world. We're not going to leave windows open at night. But in the digital world, people do it all the time. They leave ports open. They leave vulnerabilities there that the bad guys are able to scan for, and they're able to attack. And these are not complex attacks. They're not hidden. They're not zero day. They're not brand new attacks. Some of these attacks have been around for 5-10 years. They're still vulnerable, and people are still able to get in with them. So, in a way, sometimes it's easy. So why do the criminals have to change if they can do it en masse and in bulk? So if you understand your network, you've done a vulnerability scan, you understand, well, actually, why have I got RDP turned on when I had nobody remotes into my system? Turn it off and it's no longer a vulnerability. Whereas if you leave it on, yes, you may get away with it, but you may leave your car door unlocked. I never lock my car because nobody's going to steal it. Only takes one thief to walk past and try your car door. Exactly the same in the digital world. So just understand your network.
Wow, yeah. Thank you for those answers. Yes, and I'll actually ask a similar question, but first for Peter. So first off, thank you so much for your service. I really hope that you enjoy your retirement. Do you have any reflections or kernels of wisdom that you want to give us as you're leaving your post?
Oh, gosh, that's a interesting one. I don't think I've had a pearl of wisdom for about 30 years. I'll try and conjure one up from somewhere. But I just think we're better together rather than apart. And that has been the ethos of Team Cyber UK. I mean, NCSC consider themselves part of Team Cyber UK. The NCA, the National Crime Agency, think they're part of Team Cyber UK. The Home Office, the Minister thinks he's part of Team Cyber UK. Local forces, Mandy, are you part of Team Cyber UK? and so we are better together. Traditionally, people are really good at drawing really straight, hard lines between different agencies and their roles. And actually, that undermines collective effort. And we don't do that. We task together. We strategize together. We respond together. We make sure that we have people who are prepared to pick up the bags and go across the country to help their colleagues in another part of the country, because we don't believe in organizational boundaries or geographic boundaries. And that has brought so much benefit to the UK. So my pearl of wisdom would be, in this new international world where you are doesn't matter, Nat. I mean, you could be in the next little room or you could be elsewhere in Europe, couldn't you? In this international world, please, let's not try and put false borders where we don't need them.
Well, thank you for that. I see why you're going to be very much missed, but I do say congratulations on your retirement as well.
Thank you very much.
Philip and Andy, do you guys have any kind of parting words of wisdom, or Mandy as well?
Mandy,
we've only got 5 minutes.
I'm going to be brief. I mean, I think more and more as the world shops online, and we have seen just the scale up of that during the recent pandemic. Actually, everybody needs to think about their customers and their supply chain 100%. So, how would you communicate if you lost that contact? Where are their information that you hold, and actually how geared up are you? Because this could go on for quite a long time yet. So I think we just really need to think more about how to help business, all of us together.
Super. You're doing a great job over there, really.
I don't know if I would describe it as a pearl of wisdom as such, but I'm really, really positive and really, really optimistic. I think it's too easy to kind of be defeatist and think, you know, you often hear policing, oh, you can't arrest your way out of this problem. I don't actually agree with that. I don't think that's true. I think since we've built the force units, we've gone from a handful of arrests each year to hundreds, I think, and that's freed up the regions to go after the really top-end organised criminals. Some of the quality of the operational work is better than it's ever been. It's really, really exciting. It involves working with jurisdictions around the world and not always the obvious ones. The more we collaborate with business, the more we build our capabilities and the more we break down the organisational barriers to the extent that we have them. And the more we start to utilise technology in the way that we are becoming so much more efficient and effective. We're probably way ahead of where most people think we are. And we like that because we don't want the criminals to know exactly where we are. But right. I only see post-COVID, as other countries start to catch up with us and work even more collaboratively with us, and that includes industry as well, it's going to be harder and harder to be an effective cyber criminal because we're raising the bar so much and we're raising it so fast, so fast. It will become much, much more hostile over the next few years. And that's only going to be a good thing for everybody.
Yeah. What a great answer.
Yeah.
For myself, I suppose it's, you know, cybersecurity. I've been involved in cybercrime investigation now for 7 years. Majority of cybercrime, like Mr. Goodman said, you know, can be prevented by some very simple steps, strong passwords, backing up your data. You know, if you get all the basics right, which doesn't have to cost you a fortune, even if you do get attacked, you'll be able to recover. And the chances of you getting attacked, you minimize it massively. So if you can get the basics right, then you will stop yourself from being, from becoming a victim.
Absolutely super. Yeah. Well, thank you. I can't thank you, everybody, so much. And we will drop a link to everything that needs to be at the bottom of the interview. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.